This week on Potlatch, John Shively tells about implementing the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act.
About the tomato vendetta and the tale of a man who let a hate for tomatoes cause him strife. He lost his job, wife, home, car, kids, and life. He'd go downtown to buy some groceries. He went because his family was hungry. He always bought bread, meat, and potatoes, but he wouldn't touch those ugly tomatoes. They were just as ugly as far as ugly goes. There in the store, when no one was watching, he'd set melons on them and laugh at their squashing. One night after shopping and on his way home, his loathing for tomatoes cut to the bone. He just couldn't stand the strain anymore. He vowed to destroy the tomato horde. Grocery stores would still be open. His eyes grew cold, for he was a man whose moment of truth lay close at hand. All over town, in every store, tomatoes were hurt and spilled on the floor. Big melons and turkeys and large sacks of grits were dumped on their sections to mash them to bits. Finished his plan, but on his way out, a delivery van full of big ripe tomatoes drove in and hit him. Tomato Vendetta had claimed its victim. The incident of the Tomato Vendetta caused a sensation. It was something that the public could relish and readily snatch up, popularly known as the Tomato Ketchup.
That was Mason Williams, M.W., and the musical tale of the Tomato Vendetta. Speaking of M.W., Mo Wassily is out of town this week, and I'm Jeff Kennedy sitting in for him. Now to our interview with the Alaska Federation of Natives Executive Vice President for Lands, John Shively. Shively tells us about himself and his job.
I had been the executive director of the Rural Alaska Community Action Program, and Willie Hensley had just taken over as president of the Alaska Federation of Natives at a time when they were going through a major reorganization and had some major financial problems. And he asked me to come on as the executive vice president to help straighten out some of those management problems. That was in late 1972. I have two basic kinds of responsibilities. I oversee the accounting department and the accounting and audit functions of AFN, and we presently run about $10 million worth of federal, state, and private money through AFN each year. But my main responsibility is to act as a staff member to the president of AFN in land claims issues. We deal with a number of land claims issues, which we may get into more detail on later. But I'm his chief staff member on those issues. We have another executive vice president, Gordon Jackson, who oversees all the human resources programs like Johnson O'Malley program, the health program, education program, things like that.
Take me for a walk in the morning dew, my honey. Take me for a walk in the morning dew, my love. You can't go walking in the morning dew today. You can't go walking in the morning dew today. But listen, I hear a man moaning, Lord. I know I hear a man moaning, Lord. You didn't hear a man.
Dobson. Again, John Shively, this time responding to the question of whether the Land Claims Act has really fulfilled its promise.
Well, no, and I don't think that one would expect that the Land Claims Act would have fulfilled its promise by this time. If the promise of the Land Claims Act is that natives will be given in the long run of choice the kind of lifestyle they wish to lead. For those people who wish to become pretty westernized, allow them to do that. For others who wish to maintain a basic subsistence lifestyle or partial subsistence lifestyle, also allow for that. The promise has not been fulfilled, but I don't think anybody would have expected that by this time, which is about 3.5 years into the act, it would have been. I think that a lot of things have been done that would allow this promise to be fulfilled eventually. I think there are also some problems have come up that nobody expected that may mean that the promise won't be fulfilled.
Have the power and the influence of the Alaska Federation of Natives grown or diminished with the passage of the Land Claims Act?
That's a difficult question because it's a yes and no. Probably overall you would say that AFN's influence within the Native community declined, or at least power declined, as a result of the passage of the Land Claims Act. AFN is not in the Land Claims Act at all. It was specifically excluded. There's no statewide corporation. So from the point of view of the Land Claims Act, the real power and the real money, at least as I see it, in my personal opinion, lies with the 12 regional corporations. And I think that the regional corporations recognize that. It took AFN a while to recognize it. AFN, prior to the Land Claims Act, had been the leader in land claims issues, and they had taken the lead. The Land Claims Act put the regional corporations in that position, and AFN had to change to respond to that. Our board of directors is now made up of one representative from each of the regional corporations that wishes to belong to AFN, and right now that's 11 of the 12, with Arctic Slope being only the only region that isn't in. There was a time, I think, in late 1972 and almost all through 1973, where the Alaska Federation of Natives almost disbanded. For a number of reasons. The first was the failure to recognize that the regional corporations would become the powers under the Act. And AFN, right after the Settlement Act, to a certain extent, acted as though it still had all the power, and it did not. Also, AFN got into some very severe financial problems, and in late 1972, when I came on board, it was almost bankrupt. Really was bankrupt for all practical purposes. Largely through the efforts of Willie Hensley, who went without pay for the better part of a year, the AFN was put back together. There were several things that happened that helped restore AFN's power, one of the main ones being that the Department of Interior attempted to force land selection regulations on the Native community that would have substantially undercut the settlement. It gave the regional corporations a reason to band together strongly once again. And using that and other issues that have arisen, I think AFN once again has regained a great deal of power and respect. In Washington and Juneau, I think AFN is more powerful than it's ever been, probably more powerful than even it was before the settlement. Within the Native community, I think it has less power, but it's a very influential institution.
Shively was asked where the land claims money comes from.
Well, there are several. The first is who belongs, which has more or less been settled, and that is any Native that's one quarter blood or more who was alive on December 18, 1971. Those people who died before then are not enrolled under the Act, and those people that were born after December 18, 1971 are not in the Act. I think the second concept is a little bit harder to understand and comprehend, the fact that those that are born after December 18, 1971 are not in the Act. Those individuals that have been enrolled are put into corporate structures, which is different than any other kind of Indian settlement that this country's ever tried. They each get 100 shares of their regional corporation, and those that are enrolled in village corporations also get 100 shares in their village corporations. It is felt that after a while, as people die, people that were born after December 1871 can either get stock by inheriting it from parents or grandparents, or after 1991, if the act stands as it is now, that stock will be able to be sold, so an individual Native could buy some stock in a corporation. A couple other the essential features are land and money. There's $962.5 million. About half of that will remain in the regional corporations according to how big they are, how much population they have, and that varies quite a bit. Otna, which is the smallest regional corporation, has just over 1,000 people. Sea Alaska, which is the largest, has almost 17,000. So there's quite a difference in what the regional corporations get. the land is 40 million acres. About half of it, 22 million acres, will go to villages. About another 16 million acres goes to regions, and then there's some special cases for groups that people are in places that have less than 25 natives, and if we're smaller than a village. Sitka, Kenai, Juneau, and Kodiak get some land out of that 2 million acres. There's cemetery and historical sites and a few other things. So that's really a capsule view of what's in the act. What that really means to the individual takes a long time to really discuss. About $462.5 million comes from Congress, and it comes over an 11-year period. About a little over $200 million of that has been distributed so far. The other $500 million comes from a 2% royalty on oil and gas. Very little of that has come so far, only a few million dollars. But once the pipeline is built and the oil comes out of Prudhoe Bay, the Alaska Natives stand to share quite a bit. It'll take about probably 10 to 15 years once the pipeline is built to get for the Natives to get their $500 million from the 2% royalty.
Who distributes the money?
The money goes either from Congress or from the oil revenues into the, what's known as the Alaska Native Fund, which is in the Treasury. The Treasury, four times a year, distributes whatever money's in the fund to the regional corporations. The regional corporations, through 1976, distributes 10% to individuals, 45% to village corporations, based on how many people are in the village, and 45% to themselves. If a person is not in a village, they get their individual share of 45%. What that's meant in dollars so far is that for the first 3 years, which was all combined in one check, an individual, if he was in the village, for his 10% share, got about $180. The next year, he got about $90. An individual that didn't live in a village got an additional $820 the first year, so for about a total of $1,000. And he got a total of about $450 for the fourth year. So it made about a total of a little over $500 for that individual. After the end of 76, the regions keep 50% and they give 50% to individuals. There's no mandatory distribution to individuals. Now, it's felt that what will happen is that the regional corporations will begin to make some money, and therefore they can distribute profits as dividends, as corporations do. Whether or not they'll all be making a profit in 5 years is up in the air a little bit, of course. I suspect that not all regional corporations will be making profits in 5 years.
Who decides how much money will be paid each time payment is made?
Well, it's in the law at this point. Now, the board of directors of a regional corporation could conceivably say, we're going to pay more. They couldn't say less. After 1976, when there's no more requirement for individual distributions, then it'll be up to the board of directors what they distribute. The same thing for a village corporation. Now, there's no requirements at this point that village corporations distribute anything. But their board of directors could make a decision to do that.
How often are the payments made?
Well, they've generally been annually, because at this point, although the money comes from the Alaska Native Fund four times a year, there's only one major payment, and that's when Congress makes their authorization. And that's usually in September. So it'd be September would come from Congress, and then it would be distributed sometime in October or November.
How can people know when to expect land claims payments?
Well, it's difficult because at this point it depends on Congress and there's no set schedule. The only way they can find out is to either write their region or to write an organization like AFN. And even then, we can't tell them for sure. Like, I can't say for sure when this year's major payment will be. It will probably be sometime after the 1st of October.
How does the Alaska Federation of Natives get land claims information to the public?
That is generally the responsibility of the individual region, other than our efforts through the Thunder Times, which we have a page every 2 weeks where we discuss the major issues, both human resource issues and land claims issues that we're involved in. And so that's our major effort. We don't have a newsletter or anything like that. We do people that are, well, for instance, we have a Land Managers Association, which is largely regional people but has some village people on it. Villages tend, occasionally will write us or people that we know in villages on individual problems, and in that case we answer, and that's how we respond. But largely because of the problems that different regions have, very different problems, it's hard for AFN to say, you know, this is what's right for all regions. The kind of land selection problems that there are in Sea Alaska are totally different from the land selection problems in Doyon. And so it's really left pretty much to the region. Now, I think that one of the great criticisms of what's happened after the Act is that often there have been real problems with communications. It is very difficult to communicate in the rural areas. You almost have to do it by flying there. And in some regions, really, that is the only way you can do it. If you take a region like Chulista, which largely speaks Yupik, writing is just not worth much. People don't read English. So you got to go and you got to talk to them. Now, things like radio stations in the future, as RCA gets into television, I think that'll help. But at this point, it's a real problem getting information to the individual guy in the village. Often they have to rely on people that go into meetings, you know, like their land selection committee or people from their village board of directors or things like that. Sometimes those people are good about sharing the information they get, and sometimes they're not. I think there are a couple things that one has to think about when one assesses the whole act. There's a lot of people feel that the Land Claims Act is geared for failure, and there certainly is a lot of opportunity for failure. There's a lot of problems. We found, for instance, that almost every time we turn around, we're fighting the government. Every time they make a decision about native land rights, they generally make it against the natives, which means we either have to try to change it in court or administratively. Generally, we do it administratively or through Congress, and we now have a major piece of legislation in Congress that deals with a lot of problems that the Secretary of Interior could solve by just signing a piece of paper. Things like allowing people who missed the filing deadline to enroll. Things like not counting payments against food stamps, which is clearly the intent of the Act, but the Department of Agriculture won't agree. Things like setting up escrow accounts when there's money coming off of lands that will go to natives, but it hasn't been conveyed to them yet because the Department of Interior can't do it. They sort of catch the natives in a double jeopardy kind of situation where they say, well, we can't convey you the land yet, but since we haven't conveyed it, we're going to make the money off of it. And all those kinds of things, it's a big problem. There are problems between regions. The whole problem of revenue sharing, there's a provision in the Act that says when there's mineral development or timber development by regions, the region that finds the or develops the resource retains 30% of the revenues and shares the other 70%. It's very controversial what exactly is shared. Some regions don't want to share at all, some would like to share a lot, and others are in between. There have already been two court suits on that. One which is basically a friendly suit between Doyon and Nana, and another where five regions sued the other seven. That kind of thing can, you know, split the whole Land Claims Act wide open. I suspect that unless the natives can find ways to stay together, the Land Claims Act is not going to fulfill its potential. I think another message out of the Land Claims Act is that different regions are going to proceed at different rates of progress and in different ways. Some regions in the short run may do better than others, and you may find in 10 years that, you know, one corporation is making a big profit while another corporation may not be making much of a profit at all or may be losing money. But again, those kinds of problems can be solved a little bit if natives stick together. As well as all the problem, there's certainly a lot of potential. There's a lot of land. 40 million acres of land is 11% of the state and 2% of the entire United States. It's a big, big settlement. Although the money is certainly not worth the land that was given up. In other words, the natives gave a title to a great deal of land for what I think is a fairly small amount of money, still $962.5 million is a sizable sum. And that capital, combined with the land base, combined with other kinds of assistance, I think can allow the natives to really begin to participate in the economic system while still protecting lands and protecting subsistence lifestyle. It's a big challenge. But at least the natives have the tools to begin it. Without the Land Claims Act, all those decisions would have been in the hands of the government. And I think it's clear that the government, state, federal, or local, just would have never been able to have the influence to decide things so that natives would have any kind of fair chance. The Land Claims Act gives them the opportunity. Whether that opportunity is going to be realized, I think it's just a little too early to tell.
The Executive Vice President for Lands for the Alaska Federation of Natives, John Shively. Now music from Gordon Lightfoot. Gordon Lightfoot singing about all the lovely ladies. Seeing all the lovely ladies and handsome gentlemen in Barrow this week was Mo Wassily. That's why he's not here, and that's why I am. I'm Jeff Kennedy. Thank you for listening to Potlatch. Potlatch is produced in the studio of KUAC in College under Title I of the Higher Education Act.